In this condition, Aniki holds the throne, where life is brutish and chaos prone. No rights, no peace, just constant strife. What term describes this state of life? And that was this week's E-International Relations Riddle Challenge. Stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear the solution. Hello, and welcome to this week's Thinking Global podcast episode by E-International Relations. My name is Kieran O'Meara, and as ever, I am your host. And this week, I am joined by my co-host, Tusharika Decker. Hi, Tusharika. It is great to have you back with us once again.
Hi, Kieran. I hope you're doing well.
This week, Tusharika and I are in conversation with Professor Quentin Skinner about methodological contextualism, Hobbes, Machiavelli, and international relations. And it is an absolute doozy, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, don't forget to click on that little like, share, subscribe, or follow button. That way you'll be able to get everything that we upload straight to your device the moment it starts streaming. Bing! See, that's the sound of it going straight to your device. Alongside that, don't forget to go and check out E-International Relations at e-ir.info. There you'll be able to find just a ton of articles, free books, yeah, you heard me right, free books, loads of reviews, and just loads of IR content. You can't afford to miss it at e-ir.info. E-International Relations is also on social media, on TikTok, on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter, X formerly Twitter, and LinkedIn, so you can go find us there. Professor Quentin Skinner is Professor of the Humanities at Queen Mary University of London. He's written extensively on questions about historical method and historical explanation, and many of his essays have been collected in the volume edited by James Tully, Meaning and Context, Quentin Skinner and His Critics, and in his book Regarding Method 2001. His historical research centres on early modern Europe, and one of his principal interests lies in the Italian Renaissance. He's published books on Machiavelli, on early Renaissance political painting, on ideas of civic virtue, and edited Machiavelli's The Prince. The other main focus of his research is on 17th century England, where he has written on the relations between rhetoric and philosophy, including a book on Shakespeare's use of classical rhetoric, and on debates about political liberty in the English Revolution. He's also published three books on the philosophy of Thomas Hobbes, and his best-known work, The Foundations of Modern Political Thought, attempts to span the whole early modern period. Professor Skinner has authored and co-authored over 30 books: The Foundations of Modern Political Thought, Machiavelli, A Very Short Introduction, Reason and Rhetoric in the Philosophy of Hobbes, Liberty Before Liberalism, Visions of Politics, Volume 1 to 3, Hobbes and Republican Liberty, I love that one myself. Forensic Shakespeare and From Humanism to Hobbes, Studies in Rhetoric and Politics. And also works like The Return of Grand Theory in the Human Sciences, Machiavelli in Republicanism, or Republicanism, A Shared European Heritage. And alongside that, countless articles, including the very famous Meaning and Understanding in the History of Ideas. Okay, Tusharika, let's roll. Professor Quentin Skinner, thank you ever so much for coming on the Thinking Global podcast. We're ever so excited to have you, beyond grateful that you agreed to join us, and it's an absolute pleasure.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, of course. Can I offer you very warm thanks for inviting me onto the program? This is really an honor to be on this podcast, and it's also a great pleasure. So thank you very much indeed.
No, thank you. It is absolutely our pleasure. Okay, so for our first question, I'd like to ask, what is methodological contextualism?
Well, for me, that is a large question. So I hope you won't mind quite a long answer to that. So what is methodological contextualism? Well, I think that to understand the contextualism of which you speak in the case of what I study, that is moral political philosophy and history in the West. Okay, I think that for that, it's important to begin by noting that the development of this methodology was the work hardly at all of philosophers. It was almost entirely the work of historians of these disciplines. And their work, I would say, can be traced back, quite a long way to the 1960s. I mean, I'm thinking of the contribution in the United States of such major scholars as John Pocock, who died just last month, at the age of 99. And in the UK, his great friend Peter Lazlitt, and then especially in the next generation down, John Donne, James Tully, and at the same time, I was writing about these issues myself. So we were all trained as historians. However, there was, I think, a specific philosophical underpinning to what some of us wanted to say, and certainly what my friend John Donne and I wanted to say, and I think would still want to say. At that time, my own philosophical hero was certainly Wittgenstein. And he tells us in the Philosophical Investigation, the absolutely crucial remark, words are also deeds. So that is the pursuit of understanding requires that you distinguish two separable dimensions of language. That's what he was claiming. Well, first, obviously, you need to investigate what's being said. I mean, you need to know the meaning of what's being said. But you also need to recognize that language is a form of social action. To say something, this is the great Wittgensteinian claim, is always at the same time to do something. So you could say meaning and understanding are not correlatives. There's more to understanding what's being said than understanding the meaning of what's being said, always. Because what you also need to understand, and here's the thought that Austin picked up from Wittgenstein, is what is this speaker or writer doing in saying what they say? There's something they're going to be doing in saying what they say. So, I mean, for example, were they attacking some established point of view, or were they seeking to legitimize some prevailing value, or to delegitimize it, or were they seeking to support and defend some particular point of view? Or was the writer providing advice or maybe warnings about certain courses of political action? Or, I mean, and this is very important, maybe they're just satirizing the passing scene. I mean, all of these are social actions that are being performed, and understanding what's being said includes understanding the action. Okay, so there's the setting. So if I could go on, is it all right if I just go raving on like this? Well, let me try to say something then about how these considerations relate to how the history of moral and political theory was, I think, generally being written at the time of which I was speaking. I mean, that's to say, in those far-off decades of the 1960s and the 1970s. Well, I think it would be fair to say that at that time, it was generally assumed in Anglophone discourse and scholarship. I mean, things were getting different in France, for example. But in Anglophone scholarship, that political philosophy is preoccupied with a distinctive set of questions, amongst which the most central were taken to be questions about political obligation, particularly the grounds and limits of obligation, and hence topics about sovereignty and its rights, liberty and its rights, obligation, and of course, rights itself. So there was a task for the historian of political philosophy, which was taken to be to focus on the canon of great texts in which those topics had been foregrounded. And the special value of that canon was claimed to stem from the fact that it provides us with enduring insights. I mean, topics such as liberty and rights and political obligation were taken to span the historical spectrum. I mean, Aristotle asks about them, but we ask about them. So in a way, it's completely anti-historical. I mean, we're in a continual present. So the proper approach to this great canon was held to be, well, find out what they all have to say about these fundamental questions. I mean, they're all going to be talking about the same thing. Let's hear what they say and treat them as if they're contemporaries. I mean, that was the injunction. I mean, for historians, that's a horrifying injunction, but that was how it was thought about. Okay, what the contextualist wanted to say is that missing, it's missing something. And of course, it's missing any interest in what these writers might be doing in saying what they say. So you could put it this way, or this is the way I like to think about it. What was being missed was any attempt to see these texts as interventions in some existing discourse. So the bottom line for the contextualist was that if you're going to be able to say you've understood one of these canonical texts, I mean, Plato, Aristotle, Machiavelli, Hobbes, Hegel, and so on, you've got to be able to answer questions about what interventions. You may not be able to do it, of course, because it may be so remote that you can't get the context. I think, for example, that is a big problem with Plato. The contexts aren't always there for understanding exactly what's going on in the sense of what's he doing, what's the intervention. But I mean, it's very simple once you get to Hegel. It's just very difficult, but that's for different reasons. I mean, I'm now stopping. That's what I think is the contextualist program.
Thank you so much, Quentin, for that answer. And I must tell you, it's an absolute honor. And the moment Karen said you'll be joining us, I jump into this opportunity, by the way. So first of all, thank you. And I think the question that I have for you, and you briefly answered it also, what are the aims of this methodological contextualism? And how do you set about employing them?
Oh, well, good. Yes, thank you. Well, as I've been hinting, this is what it is, kind of confession. What I'm really saying is that that approach was deeply anti-historical, and that what the contextualist wants is historical understanding. So I haven't really said this properly, but so thank you. So I could say, in you know, just putting it colloquially, what we wanted to talk about, it was, what are they up to? I mean, what's going on? I mean, we can read them. We can say, I see what they say about political obligation. But what are they up to? So the way to set about employing this approach, to answer your question, is a rather strenuous one. You have to find out about the exact cultural as well as moral and political context in which the texts you're studying are located and into which they made a contribution. So you could, at this stage, you could object, but is that going to be worth the trouble? Yeah, that is a very large task. What exactly is the point of it? And that's certainly a question worth asking, because the answer can only be that you want to understand Aristotle or Hobbes or Hegel if you can manage to do so. But that's an historical project. Now, of course, some people are just not very interested in history. And so they won't be interested in contextualism. But all I can say is that I have been deeply interested in these historical questions. And many people are. I mean, even I've been able to find this out from some of what I've written. I mean, the little book I wrote on Machiavelli, for example, you can currently read in 24 languages. So there are people who are interested. So it's a very good question. But I think that has to be the answer. You have to think that the historical project of trying to see what exactly these people are getting up to inherently matters.
Okay, so this method that you explore, how does it relate to your work on Machiavelli?
Oh, well, that's a very welcome question. Well, yeah, let me try to use the answer to clarify what I've been saying. Let me think. Let me try to answer rather specifically, by way of saying something about the most famous passage in what is certainly Machiavelli's most famous work, that is Il Principe, The Prince, that's written in 1513. The passage I have in mind comes in chapter 18. Machiavelli is discussing how rulers ought to conduct themselves if what they really want is mantenere lo Stato, as he says. What is it to maintain your state, to maintain the government in being? Well, Machiavelli says, if you really want mantenere lo Stato, what you have to do is, here's the crucial advice, you must learn to imitate the lion and the fox, the volpe e leone. Very famous passage. Well, let's unpack the imagery. What he's saying is that successful government depends on a willingness, when necessary, to exercise sheer force, the force of the lion, and at the same time to be willing to deceive, the cunning of the fox. So now comes the contextualist question. What's he doing here? What's going on? Why invoke the lion and the fox? Okay, well, the first thing you need to know, what is Machiavelli doing? The first thing you need to know is he's quoting Cicero, who had written about the place of force and fraud in politics in his book De Officiis, the book on duties. The next thing you need to know is that in Machiavelli's time, in Renaissance Italy, Cicero's De Officiis was the text studied for how to conduct yourself in public life. It was just simply the text that everybody would have been brought up on. They would have learnt their Latin from reading it. But what you above all need to know is that according to Cicero, to succeed as a ruler, you must behave with as much virtus. This Latin is very interesting because the Latin word for a man is vir. So it's something manly, but it's virtus, it's virtue. So it's a kind of manly virtue. That's a complex concept in Cicero, but he says that virtus, this kind of virtue, is as much as possible what you must engage with. And notice it's the quality of the vir, it's a manly quality. So, in fact, that contention is, I think, central to Cicero's De Officiis. And what he says is, look, this is Cicero speaking now. There are two ways to win an argument and to gain your ends. And one is by force and fraud. The other is by rational argument. Now, one is proper to men, the other is probable to beasts. Force reduces you to the level of the lion. It's beastly. It's brutal. Fraud reduces you to the level of the fox. It's not manly, it's deceptive, it's unworthy. So this is what is above all to be avoided. So Machiavelli says rulers must imitate the lion and the fox. So what's he doing? Well, he's saying Cicero is talking nonsense. I mean, that is a dramatic thing to be saying at the time. It is not always rational to be moral. Cicero's whole project is to say it's rational to be moral. Machiavelli is saying that is ruinous. So what's he doing? He's rejecting, he's ridiculing perhaps the most cherished piece of political advice in perhaps the most revered guide to public conduct of his age. So he's mocking Cicero. And so he's challenging a whole Renaissance humanist approach to moral and political philosophy. So now what you see from asking the question, well, what's he doing? Is he's doing something completely extraordinary. He is overturning the basic moral assumptions of his society. So I hope that rather illustrates why we want to say, okay, well, that's what he says. You must imitate the lion and the fox. What's he doing? Well, what he's doing turns out to be extraordinary.
Welcome to this week's Thinking Global podcast episode's intermission. Now, those of you who are frequent listeners know that it is absolutely my favourite time of the week because I get to read out some of your letters. Now, this week we had an open letter competition, and the question we asked you to write in to answer in no more than 300 words was, to what extent has the post-Cold War liberal order been successful? Now, we got lots of letters answering this particular question, but we can safely say that the winner this week was Rafaela Sanchez. Rafaela Sanchez answered the question, to what extent has the post-Cold War liberal order been successful, with the following letter. The success of the post-Cold War liberal order is nuanced, characterized by a blend of achievements and challenges. Success in this context is a relative concept. On one side, the period following the Cold War saw notable advancements in democratic governance, human rights, and global economic expansion. Numerous nations transitioned towards democratic systems, while economic growth surged due to increased trade, technological innovation, and international cooperation. But a question to think about is democracy for whom? Alongside these advancements, several challenges emerged. Social inequality widened in many regions, with marginalized communities often excluded from economic growth. Additionally, new security threats such as terrorism, environmental degradation, particularly climate change and disasters, emerged as a significant concern, posing risks to planetary health and human well-being. Now the question to think about is how to deal with these new challenges. Moreover, the post-Cold War era, in my opinion, is characterized by a transition phase between competing economic models and global power structures. The long-standing dominance of the United States has been gradually challenged by the rise of China and other emerging powers, leading to geopolitical uncertainties. And that was by Rafaela Sanchez from the University Center of Belo Horizonte in Minas Gerais, Brazil. Rafaela, we loved your letter because of the nuance that you sought to explore, so thank you so much for that. And please don't forget to send in your letters. We love reading them. We love reading them out. Send them to thinkingglobal.eir@gmail.com. You want to tell us what you've been publishing on recently? You want to tell us what you've been reading on e-international relations? We'd love to hear from you. Don't forget to click on that little follow or subscribe button whilst I've got you. Go check out e-international relations on social media. And do remember that at e-international relations, all the content that you enjoy is brought to you by a team of volunteers. So if you enjoy our output, please consider a donation. There will be a link in the description box. Okay, back to Professor Skinner.
Thanks for that answer, Pindit. I know I would like to add one thing. I'm from India, and we often read The Prince as a comparative study to Chanakya's Arthashastra, and I'm sure you were aware of that as well. Okay, so moving on to my question, and this is about Hobbes. How does this method relate to your work on Hobbes?
Thank you again. This is the philosopher I've mainly written about. I think there's something very different to say in the case of Hobbes from the case of Machiavelli, whom I've also written two books about. But the framework, I think, is the same. So maybe I should begin by saying that such work as I've done on Hobbes has taken the form mostly of articles on specific aspects of his philosophy, which I've collected into two books, one of which was called Hobbes and Civil Science, published in 2002, and the other was called From Humanism to Hobbes, that published in 2018. Those are my two sort of large-scale statements about Hobbes. So what I was mainly trying to do, I think, in both those books was to give an account of what a number of political theorists, and particularly Hobbes, wanted to say about the state, about the formation and the character of the state. So, of course, I began by asking, what does Hobbes say about the state? Well, he first talks about the concept of the state in his book De Cive, his first work of political philosophy, but most extensively in Leviathan, his English version of his political philosophy. And, of course, Leviathan is the name of the state. Leviathan refers you to the state. That is his subject. Well, he begins by asking about life outside the state. What would it be like to live without law? I mean, very interesting counterfactual question. That's what Hobbes calls the state of nature. It would be a state outside the state of nature. But Hobbes, as everybody knows, has an extremely pessimistic understanding of human nature and sees everyone as basically competitive and as prone to ruthlessness in the pursuit of selfish ends. So Hobbes thinks any attempt to live your life outside the state is going to be war. Everyone is going to collide with everyone. Everyone has similar ambitions. Everyone is selfish in their pursuit. What could this be except endless war? And I mean, the most famous remark, I suppose, in Leviathan, he says, and so your life in that condition outside the state would be solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. So you don't want life to be brutish and short. So it's that pessimistic vision that prompts Hobbes to say, look, you've got no alternative but to relinquish most of what you might think of as your natural rights to do, go, be as you wish. All of that's got to go. You must subject yourself to an absolute form of power, the state, which can then protect you from the violence of your fellow members of humankind. And the crucial inference he draws is, look, what that means is, when we come to the question of political obligation, of course, it's crucial for Hobbes. How we must think about it is this: you should obey the state if and only if it does in fact protect you from humankind. It's got to give you protection. It's got to give you security. If it does, you must obey its laws. And actually, he says, there's an amazing moment at the very end of this enormous book. He says in the conclusion, he says, look, I've written this book with one reason only, which is to set before men's eyes the mutual relation between protection and obedience. If you're protected, you must obey the state. Not protected, you have no obligation. So there's, in bold outline, what Hobbes says. But I want to say, well, what's he up to here? What's he up to in saying there's a mutual relation of protection and obedience? I mean, other people might say, it's in for the common good that you should do this, or you have a duty to do this, and so on. I mean, but why this mutual relation? So there we are. I'm asking, what kind of an intervention does that make? Is there some position he's championing here? Is there something that's under attack? Is there something that he wants to reassure people about? What's he doing? These are all actions. Is he doing this? What's he doing? Okay. Here it seems to me what you need to know, I mean, going sort of symmetry with Machiavelli suddenly, is what you need to know about Hobbes is that he wrote Leviathan between 1649 and 1650. He published it in 1651. Now, he started writing it, Noel Malcolm has established, round about the middle of 1649. In the first month of 1649, King Charles I had been put on trial for treason as a result of making civil war against his people, being convicted, sentenced to death, and executed. At which point, the English Parliament not only executed the king, it abolished the institution of kingship in perpetuity and declared England to be a republic. So, an acute question has risen for everyone in the year in which Hobbes starts to write, which is the republic legitimate? I mean, can the people simply execute their king? Even if they can, he has a son. Isn't there hereditary succession? Doesn't he succeed? Happened? Is this legitimate at all? And of course, a very large pamphlet literature comes out to say, no, it absolutely is not legitimate for these reasons. Now remember the question that Hobbes asked. Who's protecting you? Is Charles I protecting you? No. He's dead. Is his son protecting you? No, he's gone into exile. Is Parliament protecting you? Yes. It has ended the war. It has brought 7 years of total violence to an end. And it is giving you security. So what is Hobbes doing? It's an amazing thought. He's a monarchist, but he is not a royalist. Do you see that distinction? He's saying, this is a book which is saying, you must obey the new Commonwealth government. It's a republic, you may regret that, but it is what is protecting you from anarchy. So you actually have a duty to obey, and you have no duty to the Stuart monarchy. Well, that didn't last. I mean, we still have a monarchy. It only lasted 11 years. But Hobbes is saying, as long as that lasts, you have an absolute duty. So look, I mean, what I'm saying is, viewed from that perspective, don't think of Hobbes's Leviathan as this great tract on the relation of liberty, obligation, and rights. It is, of course, one of the great treatises on the relationship of liberty, obligation, and rights. But see it as a vehemently polemical text, trying to get an extremely important message across, which many people, most people perhaps, do not find easy to accept. So, just to conclude, it's a tract for the times. I mean, of course, it is also a spectacular analysis of questions about freedom. We could still ask yourself, do I agree with what Hobbes says about freedom or obligation? But I'm asking something else. What was he up to?
Now that you've explored how this relates to your work on Hobbes, what I'd like to ask is how far has the contextualist method had an impact on how political theorists think about Hobbes?
Well, look, I'm prone, I think, here to exaggerate the impact of the contextualists, because I've been telling you really about those two books I've written. But I do think there was an impact on Hobbes' studies. Yes, I think in two main ways, actually. One is that if you were to reach right back a generation ago to what was being written about Hobbes in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, what you'd find is that the really major works, I mean, Howard Warrender's great book or David Gautier's book, what was Warrender's book called? Hobbes's Theory of Obligation. I mean, it's just that's all he talks about. There's this text, and I want to tell you what it says about this. Or Gautier's book, even more revealing, it's called The Logic of Leviathan. That's what you need to know. What is the logic of this book? Well, it's a very clever analysis of that, but it stops short of everything I've been talking about. Now, if you were to move to the end of the 20th century, and I think of, for example, Johann Somerville's excellent outline account of Hobbes's philosophy, but what does he call his book in 1992? He calls it Thomas Hobbes' Political Ideas in Historical Context. So things have definitely changed. But of course, there's another change, which is not surprising, which is that there's been a much greater degree of specialization. I mean, I don't think that it would be easy now to write a book which would simply say, look, here is the whole of Hobbes. I mean, or it would be an enormous book. Because if you're a contextualist, you're asking very specific questions, aren't you? And you're trying to situate texts in very specific ways. And so what has happened there with, I mean, contextualists, if I here would talk about some of my own pupils, I mean, two really major figures in the field, Annabel Brett, for example, one of my students, she writes a wonderful book on situating Hobbes's theory of natural liberty. And she gives us the whole intellectual context in which you can make sense of why he talks about natural liberty as he does. Or Richard Tuck, another major figure in the discipline, writing his book on Hobbes and Democracy in 2016, trying to tell you about the affiliations with that way of thinking about the world. Or, if you will forgive me for mentioning, the one book I've written exclusively about Hobbes, a book of mine of 2008, which was called Hobbes and Republican Liberty, which was an attempt to give you the context that would enable you to see why it was that Hobbes talked about liberty in what was it at that time a very extraordinary way. I mean, you'd expect him writing in that culture to analyze liberty in relation to slavery, because practically everyone did. That's to say, freedom is a state of non-subjection. The antonym of freedom is slavery. Hobbes says, really, no, not at all. Freedom just means people not stopping you doing things. An amazing moment. And then I tried to explain that moment, but of course, there is an analytical piece of work to be done then. But if you say, well, okay, now let's see what's going on there, then you've got a book straight away. That question, I mean, that's a bit of an advertisement for the contextualist method, but I don't mind doing that.
Thank you for that. Thank you ever so much. So, sadly, we're coming to the end of our interview, and what we'd like to ask you is a question that we ask everybody that comes on the podcast, Professor Skinner, and that is, what is it to think globally for you?
I was told that you asked that question of everyone, so I've been giving that some thought. But I mean, it's a very large question. Trying to assemble my thoughts, I think it means quite a few different things for me, actually, and I think it probably does for anyone. So this, I may stumble a bit here because there's a lot of different things to say. But I mean, the first thing I think of is that for me to think globally is to acknowledge that some concepts and some issues are inherently global in their nature. For one thing, I think there may be some concepts that every present nation state in the world recognizes. I mean, at least in the breach of not in the observance, as you might say. Maybe justice is one. Maybe that's a universal value. Maybe citizenship. James Tully, for example, has done wonderful work on how the universality of nation states, global universality of nation states, brings with it a global idea of how to think about citizenship. But I also think that there are some issues that are of inherently global significance. And this point is kind of blazingly obvious. I mean, it's a global question, what are we going to do about artificial intelligence? Everyone faces that question. It is a global question. What are we going to do about the climate crisis, for God's sake? I mean, that is a question for the entire globe. And there are many examples we could give of this kind where you want to say, well, look, we're living globally because of our interactions. So that's one thing. But I am then inclined to think about history and the global. And I'm not a global historian myself, as will have been clear from my answers. Although well, I'll leave that on one side for a moment because some people are, and an historian, I mean, another pupil of mine who's attained great eminence, I'm proud to say, I think of someone like David Armitage, who really does write global history. And David published a wonderful book, which was on the American Declaration of Independence, except what it was about was about the global impact of the idea of declaring independence. And so there was an idea that went global, you might want to say. So those are my two immediate thoughts. But and that's not what I really would want to say if I was being asked about me thinking globally. I think that when I think, well, why is it very important for all of us to think globally? It is this. It's an almost anthropological thought. We are just one tribe amongst others. And we need to look at ourselves in a global perspective. And what we see is that we're one tribe among others. I think there are a couple of points I'd like to try and bring out here. One is that that means we really must try not to be imperialistic about how we apply our general concepts in moral and social philosophy. I mean, elsewhere, people may think about those issues very differently. I mean, take the example of human rights. I mean, look, that looks global, doesn't it? But there's a Western idea of it. And I mean, it's encapsulated in the United Nations Declaration, which it says is universal. But is it? I mean, it's a fascinating but strange document. I mean, as you know, it's a universal declaration which lists 30 rights which are universal. But are we sure that we can even make sense of all of these claims as truly global? Or are we imposing a Western vision? I mean, it really troubles me in the case of universal declarations. That's not what we mean by global. We don't mean, well, I mean, think of some of their examples. What number 16, the universal right to marry. I mean, does that even make sense globally? I mean, what exactly? The right to marry? Would everyone in the world know what you were talking about? I really don't think so. Or what about I can't remember the number. Number 18, I think it is. The right to believe whatever you want. Is that a right you want to enforce? The right to believe anything you want? Would that be wise to enforce that as a right? Is that a global right? I don't mean to rubbish this famous document. Well, I do, I suppose, actually. I mean, I think that If we're thinking globally, we've actually got to think of ourselves within the globe. We haven't got to tell the globe how to think. But I also think something which is the opposite of that, which is it's a connected point, that because different societies sometimes think very differently about fundamental concepts like rights, was something to be learned from investigating those local differences. So thinking globally becomes a way of liberating ourselves from our own parochialisms. I mean, open yourself up. And if you did open yourself up, would you think we've got the right concept of human rights? I think we wouldn't, actually. I mean, that'd be a huge discussion to go into what I do think about that. But I just think, we want not to be imperialists, but we also want to open ourselves up to the global. Actually, if you think of that point, it's one that anthropologists not only known all along, but it's their trade. I mean, that there are societies which just don't think like us at all, and that you may be able to learn a lot from them. And so that's sort of global thinking, isn't it? I mean, think of Clifford Geertz's classic study of the state, and he focuses on the case of Indonesia, doesn't it, and their traditional ways of thinking about sovereignty and the state. Well, of course, we in Western Europe have been instructed to think about the state in a particular way, and especially by writers like Max Weber, who wants to define it by saying, well, everyone knows what the state is. It's the monopolist of legitimate violence. It's the monopolist of force. So he's simply repeating Hobbes, isn't he? That's what the state is. So Clifford Geertz comes along and says, well, let's look at traditional Balinese society. The state is a governing group, and it holds society together, but it doesn't do that by force. It does that by display, by an extravagance of pageantry that proclaims obedience as required and manages thereby to enforce it. It's just a completely different way of thinking about how to run a state. Think about that. Well, maybe we should think about that. Maybe we should actually think about the role of pageantry in our own societies. I mean, if you look at the news, it's always pageantry, isn't it? I mean, there's always Biden doing something or Sunak doing something in ceremonial circumstances, and we actually have a royal family, which is nothing but. I mean, we might think about all this. So I think my globalizing is seeing ourselves as one tribe, looking at lots of other tribes, trying to see if that helps us to think better about them, but also better about us. That's a global project, I think. But actually, to end, I just have to come back to West me. I mean, if I come back to me, I come back to someone who's lived most of their life in Western Europe. And so for me, thinking globally has to be about thinking about the historical relations of Western Europe and the rest of the world. And what are they? Well, we all know from the 15th century onwards, Western Europeans, beginning with the most Western of the Europeans, the Portuguese, and their global exploration, we became imperialists. We sought to control the whole of the rest of the world. And we've got to come to terms far more, I think, than we've succeeded in doing so far with what that meant. It led, no doubt, to some beneficial results, including great growth of trade and wealth in many places, but it produced appalling results. We're only just coming to terms with this. Scholars in this country investigating slavery and the slave trade and the extent to which, how is it, you might think? I mean, I remember when I first went to London thinking, gosh, this is a small and wet island, but look at this city. It's inconceivably large and rich. Why is that? How is that? Well, then you got to go to Trafalgar Square. Everyone on those horses is a general. I mean, imperialism did it. So there are also scholars now rewriting the history of the British Empire and about the global imperialism that involved. I mean, to me, the most dramatic recent example is Caroline Elkins's wonderful book on the history of the British Empire. Extraordinarily ambitious work. What did she call it? Legacy of Violence. That's what it was. So thinking globally from the perspective of Western Europe is really coming to terms with questions about empire. I should add that people of my generation were not at all brought up to think globally in this way. So people of my generation have had an awful lot of catching up to do. But it certainly led me to think, I mean, this I'll make my closing thought, that to my generation, but to all of us, thinking globally in this sense has become a duty.
And with that call to duty, Professor Skinner, I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank you ever so much for coming on the Thinking Global podcast. It has really been an absolute delight and a pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you very much.
Woof. Woof. I have to say, of all the interviews that I have done, of all the different conversations we've had on this podcast, having Professor Skinner with us was absolutely just an astounding experience. And to be so lucky to be in conversation with him at all about what it is to engage with methodological contextualism, to think that he summarized that in less than 10 minutes in just the most perfect way before exploring his understanding of Hobbes and Machiavelli prior to looking at what it is for him to think globally. Wow, how lucky were we? Okay, so before we bring this episode to a close, we have a couple of things that we would like to talk about. First of all, we are going to get to this week's E-International Relations Riddle Challenge. But before that, I would like to say a couple of massive, massive thank yous. I'd love to say thank you to everybody that's on the E-International Relations podcast team. You guys absolutely rock and you deserve so, so much credit. That is Victoria H. Bergstrom, Edward Curry, Catherine Dameron, Jennifer Engel, Nigel Huckle, Daniel McDade, Eduardo Pieroni, and Romanos Orfeus Toffis. And music was by Material Music. I'd also like to say a massive, massive thank you to Tasharika on this one for joining me. T, I don't know how you do it. Absolutely amazing. Also, don't forget to go and check out International Relations at e-ir.info. There you'll be able to find, as I've said, just loads of daily articles, lots of reviews, other interviews, and free books, all concerning international relations as the world's leading open access website for students and scholars of international relations. Go on, go check it out. And also, don't forget to find us on social media, on Twitter, X, formerly Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and TikTok. Go and check us out. You'll be able to find loads more content there. And don't forget that at E-International Relations, we are a team of volunteers, and E-International Relations is a not-for-profit organization. So please, if you do enjoy the output of E-International Relations, consider giving a donation. There is a link in the description box. Okay, this week's E-International Relations Riddle Challenge. This week's riddle was: in this condition, anarchy holds the throne, where life is brutish and chaos prone. No rights, no peace, just constant strife. What term describes this state of life? And the answer was the state of nature, for Hobbes. We thought we would tie that one into Professor Skinner's discussion today. Well done if you got it right. And congratulations to Andro Kovijanadze for being the first person to get the riddle correct exactly pretty much a minute after it was posted. So, Andro, well done. Apologies if I've pronounced your last name incorrectly. But, Andro, well done. Absolutely fantastic. Andro works at the Georgian Foundation for Strategic and International Studies and is an executive board member and national coordinator at the European Youth Parliament, EYP. But yes, congratulations, Andro. You got it quicker than anybody else did in the world. So, well done. Well done. Absolute congratulations. And also, I would like to take this time to congratulate the winner of our Open Letter Challenge, Rafaela Sanchez in Brazil. Well done, Rafaela. Well done, Andro. You both have done splendidly. Stay tuned this coming week for another riddle and another open letter challenge. So I guess there's nothing else left to say, apart from I've been Kieran O'Meara.
I'm Tushar Kartikar.
And together we've been Thinking Global.